next case this morning is Turner against JVDD.
May it please the court. David Phillips for the appellant in this matter, Stephen Turner. I think the essential problem here with the district court's opinion granting summary judgment to the defendant debt collector was its belief that for a violation of section 1692E of the FDCPA to occur, that there must be alleged intentional conduct. And the district court relied on a older case out of the District of Delaware that I think is just not good law under this court's ruling, nor under the plain language of the statute. The district court relied on Hubbard versus National Bond. There the court said you had to have an intentional violation of Section 1692E.
Before you get too much further in this, I wonder if you could tell me whether the record shows any place exactly when the prepaid local access phone service company referred this debt to JVDD for collection. We know when the Chapter 7 was filed. We know when the notice went to prepaid that the debt had been discharged. We know when the letter goes to Mr. Turner. When was it referred? Is it in the record when it was referred?
I do not believe it's in the record when it was referred, Your Honor.
So we don't know if it was referred before the Chapter 7 was filed and they sat on it for a year, or whether it was referred after the Chapter 7 had been filed but before discharge in violation of the 362 automatic stay, or we don't know if it was referred after the discharge and they knew it was discharged but they referred it nonetheless.
I am not aware that that is in the record, Your Honor. I would have to look back. I know no one argued that anywhere in summary judgment or in the appellate briefs. I don't know if it ever came out in discovery, if there was some referral slip or not. I don't remember that.
Okay.
That's correct.
All right.
That is not in the record that I know of.
All right.
Well, it's not in the record. This was because it was shown it was not intentional, right? I mean, isn't that how we let him off?
Well, that's how the district court came off. It just said, well,
but if it need not be shown to be intentional, then he would still have an ability to come back and then show how they did all the things that Judge Wood is asking about. Right?
Sure, that would be under the bona fide error defense, which is provided for under Section 1692K of the FDCPA, and that's where I wanted to lead us through the statute. The statute, 1692E, which is the primary count here in the complaint, broadly prohibits any false, deceptive, or misleading statement.
But, I mean, this does get to the point. I guess here's my big question for you.
Yes, Your Honor.
This statute is trying to regulate debt collection, of course, and your opponents argue, look, the system basically worked the way it was supposed to here. One simple letter, which we'll assume for now completely complied with the law, went out. The alleged debtor came back and said there's been a discharge. That was the end of it. It was dropped. And so at relatively low cost to everybody, it was determined whether there was something that could be done. What you're suggesting is that there should be, because of 1692, whatever it is, KC, a duty on the part of debt collectors to engage in some inquiry, maybe very simple, maybe just calling up. That's why I'm wondering, you know, what the time frame was. If it was 2 days before the letter went out, it might feel a little different to me than if it was a year before the letter went out. But you're suggesting there should be some duty of inquiry on the part of the debt collector because of your view of 1692E, that you can't use false, deceptive, or misleading representation. That's a personal responsibility on the part of the debt collector. But, you know, 1692KD would still have, or KC, sorry, would still have a function to play if you thought that it dealt with subsequent efforts. If you persisted after that first notice from the debtor, maybe then you go into the bona fide defense. I don't know. I mean, but there's a balance that this statute's trying to draw between impossible duties of inquiry on
sure.
the part of debt collectors and also fairness to the person.
Sure. Well, Your Honor's looking at is Section 1692G,
yeah.
which requires that the debt collector provides a validation notice, which is that notice that you've probably seen in the collection letters litigated in this court, so you have 30 days of disputability of the debt.
Right. Not
I would
letter.
Say I would yeah. say that part of the statute did work here. But the other part of the statute, to be free from a false, deceptive, or misleading representation, didn't work. 1692G isn't an obligation of the debtor. That's a further obligation of the debt collector.
It's not a further obligation. It's the initial obligation. Any inquiry that is not a validation letter is itself a violation of the statute.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't understand that.
If JVDB had called up your client and said, I'm a debt collector, I'm now making contact with you,
right?
I now want to inquire about this debt, and that had not been preceded by one of these validation letters, that would be illegal.
That's not correct. It only has to be sent within 5 days of the initial contact. They could still make the illegal statement, you owe this debt, they don't owe the debt. Then within 5 days, they have to, most of the time, in the debt collection industry, they send out the validation notice with their initial demand. But it doesn't affect that there's no intent requirement under 1692E. What we're getting to is the intent requirement is the debt collector's defense under 1692K. But it's not just we had no intent to violate the law. It's also we have to show we had a reasonable procedure in place to prevent this type of violation of the law, which could have been as simple as asking their client to affirm or represent, we're not sending you bankrupt accounts, we don't have any knowledge of attorneys being involved. They had no such procedure in place. And there's other procedures they could have done on their own.
Is there a national database of bankruptcies?
Well, it's not in the record, Your Honor, but there is a national program to search for bankruptcies. There's a company called Banco.
No, my question is there a national database?
Well, no, Your Honor. There is a national database of court, the court system where you could search, you know, and look up.
The federal judiciary does not maintain a national database.
Well,
maybe it should, but it doesn't.
Well,
but you're saying court by court. You'd have to go to every district.
Where that debtor lives, you could check. I'm not saying they had to do that. I'm saying that's something that was available to them. There is, I think, a national database, if you will. It's not maintained by the debt collectors. It's the credit reporting industry. They pick up every bankruptcy lawsuit, bad credit. It's on your credit report. They could have pulled it. They did admit here in the request to admit that they had the ability to pull credit reports. They chose not to. But I think we have to get back to the plain language of the statute. This court in Gearing versus Check Brokerage held unintentional violations of Section 1692E are actionable.
Can I ask you what,
yes,
in
Your
view, was the falsehood here?
That a debt was owed at all.
That your client had never incurred an obligation?
No, the client had incurred an obligation. The obligation was extinguished.
Well, see, that raises the question whether a statement is false if there's an affirmative defense to payment. Normally, one thinks of either payment or discharge as an affirmative defense. Somebody sends out a letter saying you incurred the following debt and you haven't paid it. Please pay off. Both of those statements are true. There may be an affirmative defense of discharge, but you see where I'm going? Why does the existence of an affirmative defense make false statements that are literally true?
Because in this case, the statement had been the statement was no longer literally true. It had been extinguished by operation of law.
Isn't it because the statute covers the false representation of the legal status of the debt?
That's true, too, Your Honor. That's Section 1692E2, which was a specific...
So if you say it's still a good debt, and in fact it isn't, you have at least mistakenly, if not falsely, I mean, if there's a difference, represented
sure.
the legal status of the debt.
Sure. Unless Your Honors have any further questions, I'll sit down.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Phillips. Mr. Lewent.
Good morning, Your Honors, and plaintiff's appellant counsel. Of course, I'm standing by the opinion in the Hubbard case, the statements in the Powers case, which I believe indicate that the Hubbard case was correctly decided, and of course the opinion.
Is there any federal law against unpronounceable acronyms? There certainly ought to be. JVDB cannot be pronounced in English. Maybe it could be pronounced in Welsh.
Okay, JVDB are initials. The
That's why I asked whether there was a rule against unpronounceable acronyms.
Just to mention, JV is John Vanko, DB is Denise Bugno, and those are the two principal partners, and that was just the name that they chose for the corporation, for the debt collector corporation. I believe that, and I'm sorry, I don't practice here enough, I don't know the judge's name.
No, that's okay. But I have a question for you.
Sure.
I'm Judge Wood, and
sure.
1692E says that a debt collector may not use any false, deceptive, or misleading representation, et cetera. And I'm interested in your view as to whether that imposes any obligation whatsoever. Can debt collectors just take whatever is served up to them, you know, with a completely blank mind and send these letters out to people? Or is there anything in this statute that suggests that there is some minimal duty of inquiry to make sure these are for real?
To answer your question, I believe that if the debt collector is an independent business, as it is here, if they refer to debt, certainly they can ask the creditor whether or not the amounts are accurate, but I don't believe there's any obligation. I think that.
So you could have gotten this referral back in 1983 and sent this letter out to Mr. Turner when it went out, and you would have been perfectly within your rights to do that.
Probably, although then practically that wouldn't be the case. In the affidavit of John Vanko, which is part of
the question really is, does the law prohibit you from doing that? Is there something in this obligation on the debt collector not to use misleading representation to make sure that it isn't misleading? Or are you just allowed to say, my policy is to have as little information as possible, and so I just send letters. You know, I'm a machine.
Well, in answer to your question, practically speaking, although it's on the record, it's a high-volume collection agency, and if a creditor refers a debt, there's an assumption of validity, and that's the reason for the debt validation letter. And once the debt validation letter went out, we were informed, or JVDB was informed of the bankruptcy and dropped the case, just closed the file. As to the time of a referral in this case, appendix page 14 of the defendant appellee's brief, affidavit John Vanko said that sometime prior to March 29, 2001. I know that's hazy.
Well, the reason is because it doesn't answer my question at all as to whether you sat on it for a year, whether it was a very fresh. I mean, it seems to me it would be perfectly reasonable for a debt collection agency that turned around these referrals inside a business week or so to assume that the creditor was probably giving them a fresh account.
In my affidavit, or in the affidavit of John Vanko, wasn't specific. I probably should have worded the sentence for him that between January 1st, 2001 and March 29, 2001, because that's when it was actually referred, but it's not in the record. That's correct. But that's what actually happened. One of our main problems with the plaintiff appellant's argument is that where does the investigation stop? Would you have to check court records to make sure there was no judgment? I mean, he's just saying that because...
Well, I guess one answer to that question could be... let's say, greater reliance on the bona fide error defense, because I take it once you can show you've got reasonable procedures in place, you're fine. Then if there's an error, nobody says life has to be error-free, and your procedures are enough to protect you. And one wonders what the use of the bona fide error defense is if there's zero duty of inquiry on the debt collector.
In my opinion, there is no requirement. Once the debt is referred, the debt collector sends out the debt validation letter. The debt validation letter has been responded to. In this case, it was a bankruptcy, and that should be sufficient.
So you think there's no point to having a bona fide error defense provision in the statute?
Certainly there is in the appropriate fact situation. But in this
case... In your view, what is that?
Perhaps using the wrong, sending to the wrong person, or using the wrong Social Security number. There might be some...
Well, the validation letter presumably would pick that up, too.
Right.
I don't know why.
I guess the question in this case is whether the allegation of a debt that the discharge debt is being owed is false.
I don't believe it is, because the debt collector didn't know that the debt had been discharged in bankruptcy.
No, this is the thing that bothers me one way or the other, is that one case, another circuit says that because the Act imposes strict liability, a consumer need not show intentional conduct by the debt collector to be entitled to damages. You know, and this is the difficult weighing here about whether just because this debt is discharged, technically it's false to say it's owed.
Yes, but it's not false according to the definitions that were cited in the Hubbard case. There was no intent to misrepresent
the debt. But it's an incorrect legal status of the debt. A discharged debt has different legal status than a debt that hasn't gone through bankruptcy and been discharged.
Mm-hmm. But the debt collector was not given any information, and the creditor...
Well, but all of that just suggests that the simple way to do this is to say, this was a false representation about the legal status, the special definition of falsehood in 1692E, and we've said in Gearing that there's no scienter requirement for 1692E, but there is an affirmative defense, and so if the debt collector has followed the ordinary rules, one would ordinarily suppose the debt collector has a contract with its customer saying, you refer to us only valid debts. The debt collector mails the notice quickly after receiving that. There's a perfectly good defense, and it's all over like that, without torturing the language of any one of these subsections.
Well, our position is that based on at least the verbiage in Hubbard, which we feel is good law, we're not obligated.
We're not trying to interpret some other case.
Right.
We're trying to interpret these statutes. If you were to choose the language in 1692E that in your view shows that scienter is an element of a claim under 1692E, what language would that be?
If I were to revise the statute...
I'm not asking you to revise the statute. I'm asking you to take the statute as written and tell me what language you are relying on for the proposition that scienter is an element of the plaintiff's claim under 1692E.
Strictly because of the fact that the debt collector had no information of the bankruptcy, and therefore...
No, I'm asking you to interpret the language of the statute.
Okay. Sorry, I don't have the statute memorized. Okay,
1692E. Mr. Bindi, where's Mr. Bindi? Mr. Bindi should have this statute memorized.
Yes, well, he works a lot more with
along with all the forms.
Okay. The debt collector may not use any false, deceptive, or misleading representation or means in connection with the collection of any debt.
Right. So far, no scienter requirement.
Right. Without limiting the general application...
I'm not asking you to read it from beginning to end.
Okay.
I can do that. You know, perhaps you had some understanding of the way in which this language worked, so that there was some phrase in here that created a scienter requirement, but it doesn't sound like you do.
I just have the case law, the Hubbard case, the reasoning of the Hubbard case, the fact that the Powers case supported the Hubbard case, and the fact that Judge Levin, the magistrate judge, agreed with it, that there has to be some reasonable knowledge.
You know, we have said many times that the decision of a district judge and $2 will get you a cup of coffee. The decision of a district judge has zero, nada, zip, precedential effect. There are, however, decisions of U.S. Courts of Appeals, and in particular the decision in hearing against the Check Brokerage Corporation, which holds that 1692E does not require a mental state. And I can assure you that as between the decision of a district judge in Delaware and the decision of the Seventh Circuit, we'll follow the decision of the Seventh Circuit.
Okay. Thank you. We both have the same next case. Can we stay at the same tables, or should we switch tables?
Please sit down. We'll finish this case, Marie. Mr. Phillips.
Briefly, Your Honor. It's an ostrich. Okay, that's what it boils down to. Does the debt collecting industry get to stick its head in the sand and not ask about anything? All we're asking is the ostrich pulls its head out of the sand and at least asks around, does anybody know anything about this debt?
Well, yeah,
if they ask of the most, the person who would know the most, that is your client, who knew, and it was all solved.
But the duty wasn't on my client. The duty was on their creditor. And the creditor, they should have at least taken the minimal step of asking the creditor. Or getting the file from the creditor, Your Honor.
You could describe to me a simple, cheap, instant, minimal step. That would be more interesting. If there were, say, a national bankruptcy database that the judiciary maintained that one could check by Social Security number, that would be simple. But there isn't any such thing. Not only are there 94 separate bankruptcy courts in the country,
right,
which maintain their separate databases, but under the policy of the Judicial Conference of the United States, it is not possible to check them by Social Security number. That's deemed to invade the privacy of the debtors in the bankruptcy cases.
And that's where the commercial program I referred to, Banco, comes in, because it does check them all.
That's more than $97.
No, actually charges based on hits. So you could submit a million accounts, and it only charges you on the accounts that come back as a possible bankruptcy. That's not that expensive. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Phillips. This case will be taken under advisement. Our next